Hey, it's time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy. Hello, Stacy.
Max Kaiser, you've had a very, very good week. You've been we've been on a roll with Kaiser Report coming to you from London. And I see you also made it onto BBC Two's Daily Politics show.
Yeah, we're infiltrating the mainstream media here in London. That was a good show. Andrew Neil and Alistair Heath, Joe Coburn, great group of folks.
So what were you talking about? You were talking about, is it time to love banksters? Because they played a clip from a recent Kaiser Report episode in which we asked that question. Ken Livingston had asked it in The Guardian. And we had the, I always want to call him the angry taxi driver, but the artist taxi driver. He went on a rant with you in the back seat about loving banksters. And so what was the consensus there? Mm-hmm. For those who have not seen it yet, you could go to maxkaiser.com and check it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first half of my bit, that's what they focused on. And then the second half was really the more interesting bit, which we'll get to in a second. But so in the first bit, yeah, they were talking about banksters and bashing banksters. And, you know, there was this idea at the very top that, well, you know, we need banks. You can't bash banks because we need banks. And, you know, quickly dismiss that canard, because we're not talking about getting rid of banks in toto. We're saying we're getting rid of the too big to fail banks, the oppressive banks, the banks that are committing manipulation and fraud and money laundering and undermining the economy and colluding with the Bank of England. That's what we're talking about. So we very quickly moved to the higher plane of the conversation, thanks to my deft ability to transition out of the silly buggers of trying to, you know, focus on broad generalizations. Then we discussed that, and it was, you know, you saw the show. I mean, there was basically an agreement. I would say this, by the end of the first half, people were basically agreeing with me, which is always nice.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you handled it deftly, because they underestimated you, as a few people did note. They went in there expecting they knew what your arguments were going to be, and they seemed a bit lost, to tell you the truth. They didn't seem to know how to respond to what you were saying.
Well, you know, I rely on my experience as a hockey player, you know, to play the game. You know, you have to either play the man or play the puck or play the situation, you know, it's the there's a goal there of outmaneuvering the opposition when you have many different ways to do so. In this case, it wasn't so much, the goal wasn't to decimate the opposing forces, more to just turn them around and get them to agree with my point of view, which by the end of the first half they did. Now in the second half was really more interesting, because this is where really things got very, very interesting, because in the second segment the conversation was about financial and economic literacy, and that there is in this country a need for more economic and financial literacy. So everybody in the panel agreed that the country was in dire need of some improvement when it came to financial and economic literacy. And then when it came to my turn to comment on this, I pointed out that, okay, well, if everyone on the panel here agrees that the vast majority of the population is economically and financially illiterate, then how do we explain George Osborne's proposal to swap workers' rights for shares and stocks into a population that you all agree is illiterate when it comes to shares and stocks? So is he just exploiting the situation and taking advantage of that knowledge gap, which was a really good point that came right directly out of that conversation? It was completely out of the predetermined setup in terms of what the conversation was going to be about. And there was no answer coming from the other side of the conversation, I noticed.
Yes, but in the meantime, this George Osborne plan to have workers exchange their rights in exchange for a few shares. Remember, this is what kind of Margaret Thatcher did with the public housing. So whoever was living in it at that time was able to, you know, bank some profit. And then all tore down society behind them. They pulled up the drawbridge for anybody in a similar situation to them in the future. And of course, we have the situation in the UK. It's like hundreds of thousands of families that are living in temporary housing because there's no public housing for them. And, you know, these workers' rights that they're going to give up in exchange for £2,000 each, you know, those were built up over real blood, sweat, and tears for over generations to get those rights. And now some, you know, jerks are going to sell it off for £2,000 at the blow, you know, in Mallorca somewhere on vacation, and then it's all gone. But then they come back and no rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, the best thing I read in today's paper about this was you don't need to swap the shares for the rights. Just give them the shares. Just give the shares. Just, you know, that would require absolutely no pain on the part of those giving away the shares. They give away shares every day in terms of option contracts and agreements as part of the employment agreements at the top, you know, managerial level of these firms. They give away shares every single day, millions and millions of shares. So include the workers. It would be no sweat off their balls, as is a common expression. So you don't need to swap anything for it. The fact that you want to tie it to a giving up of the rights shows Osborne's and the Tories' true colors, as one of their mission statements is to strip workers of their rights. And it's quite an ugly underbelly of this political party that they would somehow feel the need to tie everything to strip workers' rights. When if you want integrity in your economy, you want higher wages, you want savings, you want economic growth organically generated. You don't abuse your workers. I mean, unless you're a pimp that's just out there and you treat everyone like a frickin' whore, like Osborne seems to think the British population are nothing but whores, and he's the big pimp daddy. Maybe he needs to go.
Well, there are, you know, I mean, if you look across Europe, across the U.S., there is a, you know, who are the people pulling up the drawbridge? It's those facing retirement. It's the baby boom generation. And the first time we saw this, and you and I mentioned intergenerational warfare at the first time, was when GM collapsed, General Motors, mm-hmm. and the Delphi auto workers mm-hmm. agreement was basically all those thousands of workers were going to be shafted. And what they agreed was that all those in a current job, so they were mostly like, you know, 40 and up, they maintained all of their rights, their entire full pension and their $30 an hour salary. In exchange, they agreed that forever those following them will only make $10 an hour and get no rights and no pension benefits. So the ones following them are going to be working for a third of the salary, no benefits, but will be paying for those previous workers who agreed to this sort of enslavement. But you see this across Europe. The problems in Italy and France in particular, you see all these workers over 45, 50 who are just unfireable and they get huge benefits packages. But anybody in their 20s has it's the precarious generation, as they call it. They don't get any rights and very low salaries, high unemployment.
Age discrimination is a big factor. We talked about it a while ago. And what's become obvious now is that it's not a class war, it's an age war. So I even saw this on Alex Jones' site, because I've mentioned this on Alex Jones' show a few times, and he said, no, it's not the age war, it's class war. But no, it's age war. The this baby boom generation is pulling up the drawbridge, as you say, and leaving everybody 30 and under to, you know, work. You know, have at it with the alligators in the moat. You know, and So I believe that that's true, and you see it all over the world, and it's not good to be 30 or under, but you know, of course, there will be social. You know, I saw on the FT today, there's a great comment about basically the UK needs to default on its debt. And I think there's a growing awareness amongst the G20 countries that there is no way out of the debt crisis, the current financial crisis, through any kind of policy mix that will increase growth and somehow pay down the debt. And more people are coming to the same conclusion that Steve Keen has talked about in Australia and others, that there's going to have to be a debt jubilee. And now people in the UK are starting to realize what this is all about.
Well, there's a few things there. So first of all, that that intergenerational warfare, I think, is just a function of democracy. You know, they're the largest percentage of the population and they vote, and therefore politicians who quest for power will give them whatever they want, give them the free lunch, but somebody has to pay for the free lunch. And it's the younger population. On the positive side of that, there is a sort of movement, and you see this covered in the press marginally, is that a lot of young people, Americans, are for the first time actually traveling. They're going to Asia looking for jobs. They're going to Brazil looking for jobs. So that can only be a good thing, I think. Now, this debt jubilee, again, this is part of that democratic process, is that the debt is all the baby boomers. That's sustaining their lifestyle. That's sustaining their plan, their retirement plans. Their retirement plans are to flip their house, right? And behind them, they see a generation that has no money and only student debts. And it's a crisis situation. So they have to keep on growing that debt in order to grow their hopes for the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned what's happening around the world, people going overseas, going to new countries to get work opportunities. And a lot of times, you know, we talk on this show about the cross currents between the economy and political realities and pop culture and cultural trends or art trends. And, you know, today there's a big story about how pop, which is really more or less British, you could say, the pop market, the pop business. You know, we're not talking necessarily about rock and roll, are we? More of the pop music has gone global. So you have this Korean guy with the Gangnam Style song that's a huge international hit. What's his name? Psy, P-S-Y, Psy. There's a German fella now who sings in English that is very, very popular. So culturally, artistically, the barriers are being torn down. So where those barriers are being torn down, there will be, you know, people going in to get jobs. So the workforce is becoming globalized, and people who assume that in the UK or the US you'd have the best opportunity are realizing that they need to look, you know, cast their net wider. And I think there'll be more of acceptance. So the 25-year-olds in Asia are probably a lot more open to dealing with Western 25-year-olds to mix and to come up with ideas, because they realize that they're all in the same boat, and there's a certain social networking, of course, is huge in bringing all these people together. So they'll have to create their own world outside of all of the current establishments and institutions, which happens every 50 to 100 years anyway. So we're in a big trend, right?
Well, the interesting thing is to look at the crisis in Europe. So, you know, you see all the unrest in Greece and Spain right now, all these riots. Unemployment among the youth in Greece is something like 55%, and very similar in Spain. But you don't see as many protests in Portugal, but Portugal has the bizarre good fortune of speaking Portuguese, which is spoken in Angola and Brazil, these two booming economies. Angola, this is where a lot of the young Portuguese are going to Angola, Africa, because it's booming because of the oil. And they're setting up shop there. They're opening restaurants. They're opening, you know, bed and breakfast and all sorts of stuff like that. And they're welcome there. They're getting immigration, you know, visas and stuff to go there and settle there, which is again another truly bizarre thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is part of the whole trend, you know, which is nice to see. Now, the Nobel Prize Committee this week awarded their Nobel Peace Prize to the EU. And this is very silly because the EU is a top-down hierarchical institution that is no longer fit for purpose. If they wanted to give it to some kind of, they could, you know, they could have given it to Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook is more deserving of the Nobel Peace Prize than the EU. Not that Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg are any, you know, examples of, you know, greatness, but it would have been a better choice than the EU. I can think of 50 choices that would have made sense as for a peace prize in an era where we have growing tension. I mean, the EU has fostered incredible tension and violence and uprisings in Europe. They are the warmongering prize. So that was kind of stupid, but it shows how calcified and entrenched the old school bureaucratic, eurosclerotic, you know, thinking of the institutional rot that is what the 25-year-old, this generation is facing. They're not getting any help from the old guard. The old guard is pulling up the drawbridge. The old guard is taking whatever they can. They're stealing the silverware and running for the hills. So, you know, there's no help there. And this new generation realizes that they're going to have to help themselves. They have the tools to help themselves. You know, Africa is very interesting in terms of the, it's really a trendsetter on the mobile payment system. You know, mobile payments, which are being talked about in the West and in Europe, and Asia, they're already alive and kicking in Africa. So people have already developed these systems. So, and they're bypassing a lot of the infrastructure that you don't need the copper wiring in the phone systems for communications. They're going right out to the mobile networks and the social networking networks, and so there you are. It's exciting there, you know.
Yeah, I read a great piece. I remember reading some of it to you. I think it was in The Economist about Somalia. Here's a country that had no government or central bank for over 20 years. And yet it has like three or four airlines, of course, private. Like people just, some guy finds a way to buy an Airbus and starts flying around, you know, starts an airline and just mm-hmm. builds a runway somewhere to land it. And it's truly entrepreneurial. So, you know, and even the pirates of Somalia, remember they started that market to get, mm-hmm. which is exactly how Europe started. I mean, that's what the first market was about in Amsterdam, was basically getting people to invest and go in this ship going off and plundering some other area of the world and bringing back the goods.
Well, yeah, the East India Company of Britain was the beginning of modern capitalism, and then they sold shares in the enterprise to defer the risk and spread the risk. And so you see that repeated with the Somali pirates, which are echoing the British pirates. And of course, the East India Company blew up spectacularly, and they outlawed incorporation and shares for many, many years. You didn't see it come back for a while. Then afterward, they invented the limited liability corporation, which is really the beginning of the depersonification of ownership to the point where people own shares blindly and they just own shares in defense contractors and oil companies and prison operators. They don't really know what they own because they're owned in blind pools, essentially, and pension accounts, and there's no responsibility whatsoever of the shareholders anymore in what the companies are doing. And there's a huge disconnect, which is, I think, problematic. And getting back to George Osborne's scheme to swap rights, which are concrete, contractual, you know, codified in a history of contract law, which people can understand and see the written word. Are you going to swap that for a pig and a poke, you know, a bag of worms, a share scheme with where the rules and laws on the City of London change every 2 weeks? They're constantly changing the laws and the accounting laws, accounting requirements, reserve requirements, what the responsibilities of the directors are, of and that the accountants are implicated in the four biggest in crimes, the rating agencies, the fund managers. There's not a single element of the entire institution of capital that is not implicated in some major crime. So he wants to swap 600 years of contract law and rights for a piece of wampum. If he was he 150 years ago, he'd be killing the buffaloes in America and giving or he'd be buying Manhattan Island for beads. You know, he's a snake salesman, snake oil salesman, this Osborne. What a slippery little. Yeah.
Well, this is you have to explain to the people listening right now of exactly how it's so easy to give a gift of shares if you're the owner of a company. That could mean essentially nothing. Now, in Hollywood, we did that all the time. You know, you con some actor into playing or director to direct the film for free or just scale. And then you say, well, we'll give you back-end points. And that's why, of course, you know, there are only like five films in the last 50 years of Hollywood that have ever, ever made a profit. And that's very accidental. Those are like your gifted clients on Wall Street that no matter how much you try to destroy them, they still make a profit. Mm-hmm. So nobody ever collects back end points in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, you know, workers' rights is swapping for shares. I mean, when you own shares, you are entitled to shareholder rights. And the whole scheme of shareholder rights is no different than workers' rights. And it's also being the shareholders are getting screwed continuously, just like workers are getting screwed continuously. So, you know, swapping an awful rights scheme on labor for terrible rights schemes for capital, you know, is a lateral move, which is diluting by definition. It's a big way. It's horrible. It's a stupid. I mean, there's a good debate about it in the Financial Times, but the people who are supported are they support a certain what's the word we talk about when we talk about the Austrians sometimes? Not nirvana, but not
utopia.
Yeah, they're utopian. They're utopists. They're utopians. They say, well, yeah, of course, you know, shares can do this and shares can do that. Yeah, if wishes were conditions, we'd all be fat. You know what I mean? Like, oh, yeah, it's utopian. It's great. It could be great. But working contracts could be great, too. You know, I mean, workers could have a decent wage also. That, you know, that's not out of the range of possibility. But it's much easier to fantasize about the utopian vision of capitalism when you're dealing in abstractions like stocks and shares, where the laws are being written by the dealers and the brokers of the stocks and shares, and then the media follows up with simply parroting what they hear in the City of London, without any critical examination or contextualization whatsoever. So the average person gets swept up in this mania, and they end up disenfranchised, bankrupt, poverty-stricken.
Well, you know what? I have a good quest for the British people to do, or the workers who are being offered this deal. If Prince William and Prince Harry exchange their rights to monarchy, then in exchange for some shares in BT or BP, you know, let's see if they go. Let's see if their advisors think it's a good deal for them to give up their rights in exchange for some shares.
Well, you know, the idea of listing the monarchy on the exchange, you know, what would you get for it? You know, what would the offering be? I mean, there's a Saudi prince. He has his kingdom holdings, which are huge stakes in various companies that's listed. It's a multi-billion dollar float. He's worth many billions of dollars. So, okay, to take the monarchy public on the exchange, you know, you have a huge real estate holding trust. It's basically a leisure company. I guess it would be classified as leisure and tourism because they make their money from selling branded trinkets with the Queen's face on T-shirts and whatnot. It's a licensing and leisure company with a theme park called Buckingham Palace. And you take that public at a multiple in that space would be, let's say, 5x cash. But the thing about that enterprise, I guess all of the real estate in London is owned by the which one of those?
Duke of Westminster.
Oh, the Duke of Westminster. So is he part of the royal family?
Yes, he's the Queen's cousin.
So that income goes to the monarchy, essentially?
No, that goes to him. But she owns freeholds on loads of property as well. And Prince Charles has, like, the Duchy of Cornwall.
Mm-hmm. So it would have to be a roll-up of all of the dukes and squires what is he? The
Dukes and squires.
The Dukes of Hazzard?
And Prince Harry is now the Duke of Cambridge.
Right, the dukes, the princes. It'd be a big roll-up. You can't have any of these outliers. So you need all of the cousins and all these people roll up. So they got that big income play. So it's a real estate investment trust, or a REIT, pay a nice dividend. I mean, as such, REITs pay a dividend. So let's pay 5 or 6%. The direct line offering, the spinoff from Royal Bank of Scotland, went public last week with a 7% yield, which is a lot in a market where the high-grade corporate market pays probably 3 to 4%. So here you have this spinoff of Direct Line Insurance from Royal Bank of Scotland paying 7%. Now, I make the prediction that the IPO price will not hold and this thing will trade at a discount to the IPO price, a very significant discount, and that they will run into unforeseen troubles and have to cut that dividend, because 7% is an enormously high rate of dividend to be paying out in this market. But in the case of the royal family going public as a real estate investment trust with a theme park kicker, I think that they could pay 4 or 5% easily on that security.
Well, speaking of contract law, this is part of the reason for the decline in this other headline I found from Zero Hedge about world economic freedom, which countries rank the highest. Now, the U.S. for many decades was number one, or number two, right behind Hong Kong. Now it's plummeted down the scales. They say that from 1980 to 2000, the U.S. was generally rated the third freest economy in the world, only behind Hong Kong and Singapore. What has caused the drop? The report cites several reasons, including 1, the ramifications from the wars on terrorism and drugs. As we know, all your habeas corpus rights and that sort of stuff are suspended from the terrorism. But from the war on drugs, they seize all sorts of property for having like a bag of marijuana. They seize if they think you're selling it, they get the rights to seize all your assets. Increased use of eminent domain in America to transfer property to powerful political interests. Violation of the property rights of bondholders in the bailout of automobile companies. And government consumption, subsidies, and investment all rose. So the U.S. is behind Chile, Canada, Hong Kong, Singapore, New Zealand, Australia, Bahrain, Mauritius, UAE, Taiwan, Qatar, Denmark, Estonia, UK, Ireland, Finland, and Switzerland.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is what will eventually kill the war on terror, is that it doesn't make any money.
Yeah, especially when the U.S. loses the dollar reserve. Because right now, politicians can feed into the most ignorant of the people who vote.
Mm-hmm.
And they think there's no cost to it. There is no cost, they think, to the wars, because they aren't asked to pay for it, because the U.S. can just print dollars at the moment. But once they actually have to start paying for that, I think Americans are going to be very shocked at how much freedom and economic and political they lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, around Washington, D.C. has been remarkably benefiting from this, and the huge wealth in the Washington, D.C. area. So that's where all that money went. They're bringing forward 100 years worth of income to just a few short years, and they're exaggerating 100 years worth of threats in the present. They're saying, well, you're going to have 100 years worth of violent attacks over the next 12 months, so we need to spend 100 years worth of precautionary spend today will make everyone in Washington rich as if they were working for 100 years. They're going to be all multi-millionaires. All the Congress people and senators make unbelievable amounts of money. And then, meanwhile, the rest of the world is running past the U.S. The U.S. loses competitiveness. And then to get back in the game, they're going to have to go through, a transition period. So that moment's coming up pretty soon.
Yeah, I mean, to think that Qatar is ahead of the U.S. and the UAE, where there are people who are, slaves there, literally. You need an exit visa to get out. And if you're like one of these domestic servants or these builders on a building site, you get trapped there. So the fact that the U.S. is that much worse, and it's based purely, I think, on the... I wish they showed a percentage of why the U.S. has dropped so much. I would reckon that those war on drugs and terror, which, by the way, you mentioned how rich the area around D.C. is. It's primarily from that, from the war on drugs and the war on terror.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying to think of a country that is doesn't really engage in much of an aggressive expansionary policies for is the U.S. trying to become more like Switzerland, where it's just because they don't want to compete anymore. They've withdrawn from the competitive landscape. They've withdrawn from the competitive field. They just want to be a banking launder center, because it's not really a place. It's not competitive anymore. It's dropping like a stone. They're not really competing. They don't want anybody showing up and attacking them. So if that's the case, and they don't want to compete anymore, because when you compete, you encourage people are going to be angry that you're competing with them, or they're going to want to compete back or whatever. I mean, if you don't want to do any of that, what's the model the U.S. is pursuing? Is it more like Switzerland?
No, Switzerland's the third or the fourth most free in terms of economics. They also base on how likely it is that you can rise up the ranks, which in America you can't. Now I'm going to read you this headline from the American Conservative. Revolt of the rich. Our financial elites are the new secessionists. And this is from the American Conservative. So they're saying that the American elite have basically seceded from the rest of the United States. They have no concern for the state of the society or economy, because they are so beyond they're untouchables, and they fly in from helicopter from home to airport to into their private jet, so they don't even know the roads. They cited, for example, the case Robert Rubin, who he attended some public function where all these other greats and goods were attending, and he was being chauffeured through Manhattan to reach some event whose attendees consisted of the great and good, such as himself. Along the way, he encountered a traffic jam, and on arriving to his event late, he complained to a city functionary with the power to look into it. The functionary asked him, where was the jam? Rubin, who had lived most of his life in Manhattan, a place of east-west numbered streets and north-south avenues, couldn't tell him. The super rich who determine our political arrangements apparently inhabit another, more refined dimension.
Well, that is the goal, is to secede. That's true. And I remember when I was on Hugo's G4 flying to Athens, there was a magazine for people who buy these types of private jets. And one of the advertisements, the tagline was, the power to never be detained. The power of never being, of never, what's the word? Inconvenienced or delayed or, So this idea of never, ever having to be, for a moment, have your fantasy broken and your fantasy life of living a magical being that sweeps through conference rooms and conferences and events and speaking in spontaneously for anything that pops into your head. and then being awarded huge sums of money for this, that never wants to be interrupted. You never want to wake up from this dream state. So sitting in a traffic jam is something that is just intolerable. So, but there are, you know, there are 60,000 people in the world, 65,000 people in the world with cash in the bank of $100 million or more. There are now 2,500 billionaires in the world. So that's 65,000 with 100 million or more. Those people are pretty wealthy. They don't quite have I think you need to really live in a pure state of fantasy. You need closer to $300 to $400 million in cash, really, to pull that off. And so it's probably, we're talking 15,000-16,000 people, which is a pretty, you know, if you talk about the Villefranche-sur-Mer where we live, the population was, what, 4,000. So three times the population of that town we were living in the south of France live in a perpetual fantasy state where they're essentially monetizing their farts. Their farts are worth billions of dollars. They go and they fart at Davos, or they fart on the BBC, and they're paid billions of dollars for these farts.
Well, that reminds me of our friend who is the lead architect who designed the Abu Dhabi airport. And like you were saying, there's this level of secession. So he said there were five terminals, and if you were in one of those terminals, you never interacted with those in the other terminals. So there was the main terminal for the plebs. It was just the ordinary person. Then there was a VIP terminal. Then there was a super VIP terminal. Then there was a royalty terminal. So I guess that's four. No, wait. So there's ordinary, first class, VIP, super VIP, and then royalty.
Yeah. Well, I see in London now, in the in Hackney, they opened up a Burberry store for what's that kind of shop where they sell the discounted luxury brands, and it's attracted a huge number of tourists. So they're going to open up another. They're going to open a Prada and all these super luxury stores in Hackney. So in Hackney, you'll have these 60,000 or so global travelers, or there's 7 million millionaires in the U.S., another 7 million millionaires in the Europe, and then Asia, there's even more. So you figure there's probably 30 million millionaires in the world of 7 billion people. And those people, so they're going to build a high-end luxury shopping area in Hackney to attract foreign millionaires who come through there, drop some cash. And these are stores where you save, you know, 5% on a $30,000 handbag. So it attracts, of course, you know, these people show up and they're like, oh, look, I just saved 800 quid on my $30,000 handbag. I'm so happy. Let's go have lunch. And so they're building all these shops. So within Hackney, there's going to be secessionville. I mean, wherever you go in the world, there are these kiosks where these folks have created their secessionvilles, and there's demarcation and heavy security and CCC cameras and RFID tags, and you can't climb the fence and get into the luxury theme park over there in Hackney. You'll be kept. You kept, you know, from mixing, but the dollars will float in, and the politicians will take a big cut of those dollars, and they'll use that money to make sure that the locals in Hackney stay away from the rich people.
So they're going to have a secessionist movement in Hackney.
What about the celebrity chef freedom movement in Cornwall? You know, I think they beat down the celebrity chef. You know, we have to go to Cornwall now that we're living here.
Yes, I know the people of Cornwall want you to have one of their pasties. Your face is probably plastered on some pasties across Cornwall. So who did we interview this week on Kaiser Report? We interviewed John Najeri, and that was funny. I didn't know how that was going to work out. I follow him on Twitter, and it's always really interesting to me because you know, he's an options trader, but he really notices things long before other people do, just based on volume and sort of unusual movements. And you often see them, I guess, more exaggerated perhaps in the options market. So sure enough, like, for example, I remember him tweeting about Green Mountain, which suddenly there were giant, enormous volumes in the put options. And then sure enough, a day later, Starbucks announced that basically they were getting into the same market that Green Mountain Coffee was in. And Green Mountain shares plunged. So somebody knew ahead of time, but he saw that in the options market. But you were a former options trader, so you got to speak to this options guy, and you talked about high-frequency trading and naked short selling, which he, again, talked about seeing in the markets. He knows it happens because he sees it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the options market are like the extended nervous system of the market. So they are in the fingers and toes and, you know, pick up the signals first before then it even gets to the main centers of stock trading. And it's a very leveraged market, and it's a very active market. So the options market is telegraphs stuff pretty quickly, gets on to what's going on pretty quickly, which is why you always hear about how when events occur, you know, the options markets were active before the events, you know, famously with 9/11. But he had some good stuff to say. I had no idea that options actually have introduced options that expire in 1 week. You know, options used to be set up for 3, 6, and 9 months. So the 3-month options were the least, you know, the shortest term options. So they come up with options that are expiring in a week. Yeah, it's crazy. There's no use for it, really. It's just a guaranteed, you know, money loser if you're trading these options over any period of time. I can guarantee you're going to lose money if you're just. I mean, it's no different than a slot machine. So if you're just buying or options, I mean, it's like putting nickels in a slot machine. You're just guaranteed loser. I mean, there are strategies that use options as hedging vehicles. Well, that would be a different situation. I mean, options have a good use as a hedging vehicle, but to just speculate with options, unhedged options, and they're huge commission generators. I can tell you, being an options broker myself for a while, you make a lot of commissions, which is good for brokers, but it's bad for the customers. And he also made an interesting point that these stocks like Apple and Google that are trading for $600-$700 a share, it really has brought in huge interest from options traders, because if the company like Apple were trading at $20 a share or $30 a share, you could, let's say on margin, putting up 50% of that, buy shares for $10,000 or $15,000 to buy shares, or, you know, $1,500 to buy a share. But now to buy these stocks requires a lot of upfront capital because they're so highly priced. So people are gravitating toward options, which is a shame because most of those trades are going to expire worthless or be closed out at a loss. Without, it's more than 90% of the option trades are closed out at a loss.
So, you know, options originally, so when they were, you said it was 3, 6, or 9 months or a year, I guess. I mean, it was primarily developed, right, to help commodities, farmers. So they didn't know what was going to happen with the weather in 6 months' time before they were setting out to, you know, this expense of planting the seeds and, you know, buying the seeds and plowing the fields and planting it and waiting for it. So, of course, they didn't need a contract that would expire in a week because it's going to take 6 months to do the whole process. And so now a week-long thing is just pure speculation. There's no genuine hedging sort of requirement if you're actually producing or planning on holding anything to the long term.
Well, the development of futures along with agricultural demands is, we see that going back to Japan hundreds of years ago. The options market is relatively new. It started in listed options in the late 70s, early 80s with the introduction of the option price volatility formula, which allowed for exchanges to price options based on how volatile they were and then to create a market around that. And then options and futures, there's a tremendous amount of trading that goes in between these two markets. And you can use options to hedge futures and futures to hedge options, et cetera. But yeah, originally they were, as you say, tied to agricultural so that farmers would have a way to insulate themselves from price volatility. Then in the 80s under Reagan, under deregulation, a huge wave of deregulation swept in, which allowed for options and futures to be traded on financial products like treasury bond futures, interest rate futures, currency futures. And so this is when you had tremendous growth in the securitization and the derivatives market and transactions really become huge based on trading in financial products themselves with other financial products. This is when the derivatives bubble started to increase in size exponentially because there's no end to how many ways you can bet on a bet that's based on a bet on a bet on a bet. I mean, the whole idea of rehypothecation in London that we've talked about, where you can lend out the same security an infinite number of times, holds true for the options and futures markets, where on the over-the-counter futures market, you know, you can write a contract, an option contract, based on something that already has been pledged as collateral on something 100 times, 200 times, 300 times. There's no limit to it. So you just have this incredible, dense, cross-traded, you know, plate of spaghetti of contracts that are referring to each other. And so when the crisis comes, it all blows up because nobody really knows who owns what at any given time and who's collateralized what. And it exists in a derivatives hologram, as I've said before, where there's an appearance of something going on, but it's just pixels or photons captured in space. There is no actual economic activity going on there. It's just an illusion of something going on.
And finally, speaking of illusions, but where it meets the markets in the agricultural sector, GM canola takes a cut. Farmers selling genetically modified canola are facing discounts of $14 to $30 a ton for their grain. The price disparity between genetically modified and conventional canola is up to $30 a ton at some sites. McBride said, one of these, the guys at the market said that the premium for the conventional, i.e. non-genetically modified canola, was due to the demand from the EU. And he said that the bidding, the bids coming in for the genetically modified were just three guys. Of course, those are from the three big ag in America who buy in bulk for the Americans who just consume anything without questioning, and they don't even have the right to know whether they're eating genetically modified foods, whereas there were dozens of brokers bidding for the non-genetically modified stuff. So that was all coming in from Canada, where most of the non-GM canola is grown. And so the Canadians were getting the basically that $30 premium.
So the non-GM stuff is trading at a premium.
Yes. So the market's deciding. The market says that's worth more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that makes sense. The genetically modified seed companies are engaged in a lot of underhanded tactics, like they're polluting and destroying the existing non-GM stocks in an attempt to wipe them out. So the non-GM stocks are being exterminated. They're being euthanized, aren't they?
Well, they themselves, the likes of Cargill, who they use here as an example of their genetically modified materials, they claim there's huge demand for their product, and that this is what the consumer wants. But obviously, in the actual raw pit of the trading, the commodities pits, it's showing otherwise, that there's more demand, there are more bids and brokers there bidding for the non-GM crap.
Well, yeah, they can get a higher price for it. But, I mean, when they say there's huge demand for their GM product, how are they defining demand? And the prisons that that are being built and people thrown into the prison for the benefit of the GM companies, the genetically modified companies, to feed them food against their will, that's going to, you know, screw them up. I mean, what do they mean by demand? I mean, demand, again, it's another one of these economic terms that, it sounds reasonable, but when you explore it a little bit, it's just an abstraction, you know, that you really have to dig down and understand what is it meant by demand in this case. I mean, you can say anything you want to say. You can say anything you want. How's that song go? You can be da da da.
That's a good place to end the show.
All right, well, I guess that's it then. We're in London.
Great. Okay, that was The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM right here in London, the best station in apparently the known universe.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Bye, y'all.